that he was faking it, that he was not completely believed in what he said or thought that it solved the problems that the thought form presented itself as doing. He even said in an essay in the 40s that the new artist has to infiltrate, quote, decent society. And so I found a note when I did his archives where he said, I identify with the underdog. And he named the American South, the French Canadian, and the Catholics. And that was in a Protestant country, the Canada. So he purposely put on the modern institutions, whereas Huger put on the particular religious cultural heritage of India and then all religions. And Krishnamurti did the same thing. It's interesting, the doubleness of existence. And I'm just describing the fact of perception here. Like when Scott said, there's experience and then the mind's reflection on it. And whether they were intertwined or not.
I would say that experience is a mental process.
Yes, and yeah. I would agree with that. So
it is thought. It is thought. It is memory. Couldn't recognize it. You couldn't recognize it if it wasn't. You see, because thought is recognizing itself. That's all. Its own thought. Right.
And the popular idea now is that we're in a hologram, and we're in a big thought, in a big memory theater. And so that means that the simulation around us can be thought. And so our images of the boundaries of thought are cultural or personal. And so when you say it's all thought, I don't think of that as just the sub-vocalizing in my head.
Yeah. Look, we have to use a language to communicate. And whatever background we have, that's the language we use. So UG and JK were using their own background, which was a mystical tradition, based on Hindu and Buddhist thought, which was a kind of a what theosophy was teaching in its ideas, and the Catholics will talk out of the Catholic background and so forth. And philosophers will talk out of German philosophers' background or Indian philosophers' background or Chinese philosophers' background or so forth. We have to use a language or we can't communicate. And that language is going to be is imperfect. We know that. It doesn't convey, the real... it only is a descriptive process that goes on. So... one uses their own background as a technique, as a way of talking about whatever it is they're talking about, and that's all they can talk about because that is their background. It's what's been put into them from childhood, and the genes and the genetic programming. That's there, there may be other factors that we don't have a knowledge of that are involved in this. Whatever it is we're talking about, it's going to fit into some system, because otherwise we couldn't talk. Got it? It's kind of difficult for me to describe this or talk about this. The mystic can only talk about mysticism because that's his interest and experience. And someone else who is not a mystic will talk in a different way because that's their background, their experience. So... just a minute, I'll close the door.
Okay.
Okay. Someone came to the house and was talking. So.
Right. But, Robert, I got what you're saying, and I want to say we're in a different, a new situation because we hear everybody's experience blatted at us, and we blat back now with the internet. Much storytelling and tale telling is our existence today in all kinds of different forms. You know, movies, television, books, magazines. Go ahead.
Well, it's a form of storytelling. It's just hyped up because of the electronics and the speed, the science behind it and so forth. So we're doing the same thing that we did thousands of years ago. It's just that we're using a different medium, and it's faster. Look, I'm talking to somebody thousands of miles away.
And it's being recorded and be available, within 24 hours.
Right. Fantastic. Before, you had to have a scribe. Well, first it was repeated, memorized, Then they wrote it down. And now it's a whole new media, whole new game. And that's why it's moving. That's why the world, and we talked about this, is moving so much faster.
Right. And to me, talking about Krishnamurti stuff and UG's Krishnamurti is a limited subject today because it's the old religion stuff, and it's a monologue, or it's what they call logocentric. It's verbal. Like when you get off the phone here, you can listen to radio. You can process a lot of information, at will. So this topic, I see that. I often wonder if Rai, as presented through Worcester, it's not just the awe of religious priesthoods or gurus or teachers that most of our civilization has been hypnotized by. We now have Well, I'm saying now we have a new kind of hypnosis, and it may not even be a problem. It is a problem for the old hypnotists, for the Pope and the Dalai Lama.
Bob, the new systems are the outgrowth of the old. It's the old in a new form, that's all.
Right, but this is a pretty interesting new form where,
it's the same. It's the same stuff.
From the private perceiver's point of view or perspective, but I think the collectivity that's experiencing itself is different. The collectiveness.
It's just accelerating faster and faster and faster, people are going to wake up faster to the fact that what they think they're thinking has no value.
Right, but now they can float in reception and interaction and communication media, that it isn't a problem that it's that thought and spiritual.
It has its escape, of course. Now
it's escape.
The new cell phones are going to be offering movies now soon, and so people are going to be less connected to each other because they're going to be looking at movies all the time. I go to a little coffee house here in Tucker Village, Coffee Day it's called, and all the college kids are there, and I sit there and I observe. There'll be a table of girls sitting there, or guys, a mixed group, and all of them are on their cell phones talking to somebody else. And yet they're supposed to be there, sitting there, talking to each other. But they're so preoccupied with this extension, availability of communication outside the relationship that they're having, that all this is taking them further and further and further away into abstractions.
Well, I don't know if there's a problem with that. It's a problem from the old perspective, which you seem to be expressing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're not in communication.
Ah, well, what is there to communicate? It's just thought.
Well, it's just a limited relative communication.
Right, well, these kids are expressing the highest levels of UG awareness. They know it's like driving around in France in the car. They are not going to stay just focused on who they're with. They can take advantage of interacting with other people, and it's more fun because you don't have to look at them and whatever advantages you feel instinctively using the cell phone.
My only comment is that there is two worlds There's the outer world, the physical world, universe that we live in. And then there's a reflection of that, a mental reflection of that, called the inner world that we have. And the more we get involved in the outer, the less contact we have with the so-called inner world. And it's very important to both those worlds be in balance. Actually, there is no real separation between those worlds. It's the attention we put, whether it's the inner world or our attention into the outer world. But without the inner world, we don't understand our actions in the outer world.
Okay, now Robert, you're talking like a teacher here. You're making a point. You're making a point here. I don't think you believe in that point, but this topic has made you say that point, and I find it interesting you say that point, because I don't agree that that point applies. And this is partly playful. I mean, what the hell am I grieving?
It's okay.
No, I'm not concerned about your feelings about what I'm saying, but I'm just talking to myself here and saying, oh, well, I don't agree with what I'm saying. Or the thing is that it's interesting to look. I've heard this complaint many times from people. You know, on my other show with James, every week he talks about the ridiculous cell phone usage in Los Angeles, and people say this is a mess. People aren't talking to each other. Well, UG showed us that we were just machines or chemicals or something.
We're just talking with different people, but we're not in contact with who we're with in our present relationship. So we get further and further and further distanced away from each other. That's all.
Yeah, and that is not a problem, is it?
Well, it creates lots of tension between the parents and the child, between the boy and the girl.
Yeah, we've had lots of tension before.
But we're just getting further and further, you know, isolated from each other. You know, we are already isolated. I agree. And we are an island. We really, really are living on our own little island, and we're not in communication with anybody at all. We have absolutely no communication with another human being. But in the social world of everyday living, we pretend that we're in communication, and this makes for relationship, and this makes for ability to get things done, to buy something, sell something, exchange something, live with somebody, have children, something.
Is somebody interrupting?
Yeah, but I'll catch it later. It's okay. Do you follow what I mean?
Yes, and I think what you're saying is that 90% of reasonably educated people, or even the average peasant, I don't know, Indian peasants see this, but the majority of humanity would agree with you. It does seem that the world is getting messier, no communication. These seem to be obvious perceptions. So I'm saying, well, maybe we're not seeing it right. Maybe there's a solution. Even though we have the war going on in Israel right now,
And Iraq, and in South Africa, everywhere it's going on.
But those are
going on, and it's going on with each person.
Right, but those places you named are puny places. If the news didn't talk about them, it could focus on the deaths. Could be focus on the deaths caused by other institutions, like medicine or something. There's all this destruction going, but maybe all this hyper-communication, beginning with the TV and then cable TV and all that stuff, prevented people, distracted them from leading to the nuclear war scenario that was sort of seen happening in the 70s or 80s or 90s. Maybe this, on the collective level, this huge distraction didn't allow the leaders to get people focused to have a big fight, and it dispersed it. And that is what Worcester says happened, which is an interesting thought. And I see that in media, that media did save us this way. Now, if you propose, like Obama is proposing some kind of attempt at solving this situation, it's supposedly a new agenda, unify the country or something. Yeah. Is he another Rai, another Pope, another illusion? Or would you agree? Yes, but
no,
would you?
No. He can't possibly solve the problems. He can maybe lessen the effect of those problems, modify them to some degree, but he's not going to solve them, no.
But you were saying that it's getting worse and we're losing contact, and that implied that you were concerned that you would want to do something on the social public level.
No. I just see this as a fact. It's all. It's just a fact. I can't interact and say to anyone,
Hit your cord there. It's flickering. And you know,
the joyride is there. We're on the joyride. We're in the back seat. Yeah.
Well, that's what these kids. That's what these kids are having. The joy of communication. Hyper communication.
Right.
It's a joyride.
Yeah. Well, what are they talking about? Yeah. The same thing that they talk about if they were if they were sitting across from each other. It's just another extension. It's just another, they're just talking in a wider sense to more people. They have access to more what's going on. I got an email from a friend, an Indian friend, and he wants me to chat with him on the email. And I said, okay. I said, why don't you come over and see me? But it's fun to sit there on his computer and do the computer thing, you know. I'm just the poking the fire a little bit. want to talk, if you really want to talk, let's talk, you know. But we don't want to talk, really. We just want to chat and pass the time. The Indians have a thing, time pass, they say. You ask what they're doing, time pass. You know.
And they have an Indian word for that?
Just English word, time pass. Oh, probably
that's
Indian
the word. They say in English, that's the English word, time pass.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the Wikipedia dates. You have Krishnamurti, May 11th he's born, so he's a Taurus. And Yuji, born in July, he's a Cancer. Could you look at their different styles astrologically?
Well, I don't know astrologically, but they certainly were different styles. I mean,
yeah.
J.K. presented himself as a spiritual teacher of great heights. And, there was an aura of spirituality, and a certain theatrical structure was there. It's theater. It was theater, you know.
Yeah.
And so Yuji's theater was for madmen only. Like, it's limited to a small auditorium, like it's 12 seats, you know.
Right, right.
So the fire could be hotter. It could burn faster.
Yeah, it was off Broadway. It was Yuji. Yeah. Off Broadway.
Yeah, he was more cruder.
Yeah, and experimental. So I want to say this, is that if you take the general characteristic cliche of Taurus, they were stubborn. I understand the general characteristic of Cancer is they like family and I don't know, dealing with domestic issues. It seems to me that Yuji, the way he actually would focus on one person like Lisa and work on them, help them, like a mother or a father.
Yeah, he said, I'm a householder.
That's a Cancer characteristic, and definitely.
Why should I be a monk? Why should I deprive myself? You know? Why should I do that? You know.
Whereas Judo Krishnamurti, he was a big lion head, not a Leo, but stubborn. He was stubbornly maintained his position all his life. You know, he was like a bull. He was a spiritual bull.
Yeah, and he had to maintain a certain, image.
Yeah,
of that. Yeah, he was monkish in his ways, lived in a very simple way, you know.
Yeah, the time school. He withdrew from society into another dimension. Yuji stayed in the muck. He had the time school philosophy in there. He could bring in the Krishnamurti time school, and he had that as part of his thing, but his actions also were involved, and he ran around the ricocheting of experience and driving around his car.
He lived very much in the world, of an ordinary common world. He was a common man in that sense. That he didn't try to be, anything different. You know, we go to a department store or someplace, and he would be looking, shopping around, looking at things. He loved to look at things and feel material and find out where it was made and so forth. Sometimes he'd buy something, a shirt or some whatever. And I used to think, the person waiting on him absolutely has no idea, who she's dealing with. Or who he's dealing with. They have no idea what he is, What a very extraordinary, different, rare kind of person he is. But he made no pretense to be anything different than just an ordinary person. Very ordinary.
Right, and you're talking about the shop clerk wouldn't realize that unless they... started talking to him, and then the conversation led to another level, then they might say, this is a different kind of person.
Yeah.
But he
never presented him. He never had a limousine. He had a Ford.
Ford. But the...
Krishnamurti could ride in the Bentley. The best car in the world. And Yuji would walk, if he had to.
So you see the relevance of my quote at the beginning, the time school and the space school. They are accurate. And they both were...
Well, you and I have just described that in the same way, using very common, ordinary terms.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Right. Yeah, now the...
That's basically how I function. I try to reduce everything down into to a common, ordinary language that people use every day on the street.
Yeah, like I was thinking when I read this, I said, which is Bob, to the degree that Bob's anything in the spiritual world? I would say you're more of the time school, but even though you don't believe in it, your style is more the monkish. Worcester, yeah. I would say Worcester's more like UG, he has these. Well, no, you both socialize. You both are involved. So it's interesting. You couldn't put you either in either school. You could put on either thought form in your style. But I'd say that Worcester. I don't know how you live. I haven't seen it, but just how you describe it, I think that maybe Worcester lives a messier life than you do, so that it's as UG is messier than JK, it's Worcester is messier than you. That ratio,
life is chaos,
right? And Worcester's not complete chaos, but it's been chaotic a lot. Like when we were in LA, and you were up there with the Time School Hollywood, a little more elitist. And access. Yeah. Well, Dave and Paul were running around on the street level trying to get something going. There it is right there all along. And probably when you first met Worcester, he seemed coming from the lower echelons of confusion more than you were at that time in 56. You were in a guru position, a little more control of your situation. So he was a messier person. Like you said, he seemed a little off.
David was looking for the answers. He knew that there was something different than what he had, and he was having the usual problems that people have with relationships and his job and the political structure in work and so forth. Yeah, he saw the inadequate problems that exist in our social framework and structure, and he was looking for answers, and he found his way to the center there, and he had some legitimate questions to ask, and he was looking for the answer for them. I did my best to steer him in the right direction so he could discover those answers for his questions.
Right, and you had gone through what he went through a bit earlier. In your life, even though you're born the same year, and you were in a position of a teacher kind of position in relation to him. At least you were familiar with where he was going, and he didn't know where he was going, but where he was going to be leading into predeterminedly. You had the Krishnamurti book to show him, you had this and that, which he knew nothing about. And
yeah, I tried to point out what would help him, and he was a smart person, intelligent, very intelligent. And
he responded.
He had the wherewithal to respond to that. Yeah.
I
mean, I saw from my viewpoint certain problems, but I knew that he had to solve them himself. You know.
Yeah, and you guys, and when we did the taping of you guys talking a couple months ago, what you would say, he would agree with. What he would say, you would agree with up to a point. But it's interesting that he would agree with your indifference to religion and all that, the spiritual quest, but he still thought there was some place to go. So in a sense, he had the Krishnamurti position, and you had the UG position. So he went from the messy UG world to the Krishnamurti level. You went from the Krishnamurti level to the UG world. But you may still maybe more on the Krishnamurti side in your personal life. I don't know how messy it is. But that brings up two personal questions. Do you think that Paul, who in 2000 or so, when he left the restaurant, he spent the next few years with UG. Do you think that he needed UG more than you? Or he had other reasons to hang around with UG longer than you did?
Well, I don't know. You know, he went to Switzerland and started hanging around with UG, hanging out there. He was welcome. UG welcomed him. He never told him to take off, get out. You know, he made a lot of friends, a lot of people, a lot of Germans that were hanging around UG that had been involved with Rajneesh and so forth. Now they were looking at UG as their guru and so forth.
Did Paul work there? Did Paul work there?
No. We both had enough money from the sale of the restaurant to stake us for a while, you know.
Right, so
I'm still living off of that income now that I have.
Why was he not as bothered by UG as you were, or maybe was, but how come he could handle UG through those next few years?
Bothered? What do you mean bothered?
Well, you would be hanging around with Eugene and say, what the heck am I doing this for? You wrote this in your book.
Oh, yeah, right.
Did he have those kind of frustrations himself, Paul?
Yeah. Every once in a while he would blow up and bark, or blow up and become very critical of all the people there and bark at them, you know. We use this term bark.
But he wasn't into going to India and writing a book, so he likes Switzerland.
Capable.
Yeah.
Capable. Far better writer than I am, so he has a knack.
So does he have anything to say about having hung out with UG longer than you? Does he think, well, I saw some things you didn't see, or would he say that I never learned anything more than you learned, Bob?
Oh, I don't think that question is there at all. No, I don't think he would entertain that question. You find out that you're not learning anything. You're getting rid of things.
Okay, so did he need to rid more than you did? Had you rid it before he did? Rid it off?
I don't know. I don't know, you know. I just don't know. Well, he was there because he had a part to play.
In that, what was in that relationship. Part? What was that part?
Rational. He was one of the participants that was perhaps more rational, more logical, more intelligent, more understanding.
And Eugene, you think, valued that?
Yeah.
Right. So the would he live with Eugene or have his own place?
No, Eugene always lived by himself.
Oh, I say, so Paul had his own place. This was in Gestad?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Mario, the Italian fellow, who used to be a Vajrayana, and would take over the finding of a large, rooms for everybody. He would, and he would get involved and take care, help people find a place to stay. So Paul found a, he was living in a chalet with some Swiss people who were renting out a room. The Swiss are really, wherever they can make an extra franc, that's what they're into. So they have an extra room in their house. They'll rent it out to a traveler, someone visiting Gestad or Sanen there. But I had a place very, very close by. He could walk to Yuji's abode, his cave, he called it.
Who called it cave, Paul or Yuji?
Yuji called it a cave.
Okay.
His cave.
Yeah.
Because he had a cave in Rishikesh when he was up there studying yoga.
Yeah.
And there was a monkish side to Yuji, very much. A very austere,
what we call ascetic. Type. Ascetic.
Yep.
Yeah. But did Paul have lovers in Gestad?
No, but he met this girl, Varesha, who was an ex-Rajanisi, and they became friends.
And lovers?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so Paul could be bisexual too.
Yeah.
And is he still with her?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She lives in Cologne.
Right, so he has a bit of a relationship there, that he's...
Yeah. You can't live... I mean, how many of us can live alone, It's difficult.
Well, that's
if we live alone, we still have relationships outside, being alone. We still have friends. We still, So, Paul is a social person, so...
Well, that is the underlying ecology in human existence, is that as different and struggling and suffering and conflicting we are, basically humans hang out with each other. They are a basic comfort for each other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
On the raw animal level.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
And different personalities have different ways of being frustrated and expressing it. Some couples, right. Friends like to argue and yell all the time. Other people, they don't want to do that. They do other things, or they do separate activities and get together occasionally, like artists. But it looks pretty. If there was a superior being, whatever that experience is, it would look like that humanity's having a good time. If it realized that there was no death, now if there is death, maybe and you don't survive it, then it may not be pleasant. But if there was no death, then humans are having a good time, and expressing all kinds of different conflicts for the experience of it.
I don't know how good it is, but
well, if we survive death, if you survive death, that really changes everything, because then you can maybe come back here and do other things, and we'll make this whole dimension playful. Now, I'm not saying that's a fact, but definitely
this is a myth we have, the idea that we survive death. I don't want to die. I don't want to come to an end. That's my primal fear I have.
But you will, and you will like it when it happens, because when you die, you're ready to
die.
All deaths are suicides.
Yeah, okay. You will die. You will die.
Can I jump in for a sec?
Yeah.
What if we die and then discovered that we didn't die, and then discovered that was a problem, that we actually wished we could die because we can't die.
And yeah, good point.
And there's some implicit suffering in the fact that we can't die.
Yeah, you always have consciousness.
Well, yeah, the thing is that the universe. Nothing is ever destroyed. It just gets recycled. So, well, people came upon this understanding through mystical experiences, we'll say, and it got translated in that I will survive my death and live in some kind of subtle astral plane, and after a period of time and experiences, I will get sucked back into the human form again. And so the idea of reincarnation and rebirth and so forth. And maybe there's something like that as far as the energy is concerned. The energy never gets destroyed. Nothing ever gets destroyed. It just reorganizes itself and the universe uses it in some other way. So, no doubt, wishful thinking on my part, that when I die, the memories that I have of Robert may exist in some kind of subtle state for some period of time, or may go on forever, I don't know. But as far as an entity, a me, a center, something permanent, that doesn't exist. That's a hope born out of our fear of coming to an end. There is no center there that is me, permanent, individual, separate, experiencer. That is a myth. So that's not going to survive. So when I die, I'm going to die. But what I am, what the essence, the structure, the memories, the energy, all that's just going to go on in some other form.
You don't believe what you just said. You believe... well, how do you know what you just said? Why did you say that with such certainty? Because for the sake obvious. Of conversation?
Obvious to me.
Can I jump in again?
Yeah.
I was with some people, some spiritual seekers recently, and...
Pity.
Yeah, and...
Sorry to hear that, Scott.
Yeah. and some people in the group started to lament about their feelings that they weren't... They're seeking and they're working so hard on the spiritual path, and they're not waking up, they're not enjoying the spiritual rewards that they expect that they should have, because they're being so pure in their spiritual seeking. And I said something that upset everyone in the group. I said it's the I that's seeking that is the source of the problem.
You quoted Eugene Krishnamurti and everybody else.
Yeah.
That's okay.
And yeah. It really upset people, and people's defensive reactions kicked in, and somebody said, there's a deeper I. And I said, and I thought about what Eugene said, which is that if you think that you have an I and that there's some other I that you've yet to realize, that's an artificial split in the mind that doesn't exist. So I said, no, there's no deeper I. It's all ego. And
there's no I there any. There's no I there to begin with. You see, it's an assumption thought has. Thought thinks there's an I. It protects that I.
So what happened, Scott? Anything more? Yeah, anything more, Scott, happened in that story?
One person actually sort of snapped out of the hypnosis of being being trapped in the concept of an I, and said, "Yeah, so when I'm earlier he'd been talking about this problem that he'd had. He was trying to get a stain out of the floor that he was scrubbing, and he said, "Oh, well, there's no problem. There's just the scrubbing and the stain, and there's nothing else there, right?" And I didn't agree or disagree, but that was about the best anybody could say.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. That's the scrubbing and the stain in the floor, and that's the fact.
Scott, you were on the edge of becoming... Yeah, Scott was on the edge of becoming...
Anything else about it is... You see, you can...
Oh, no, Scott, Bob, let me say this. Let me just say this. Scott was on the edge of becoming a guru right there. He was almost...
Yeah, okay.
That's something. He goes on a roll. He made them not... He became not liked. That's the first step.
If I could just become a guru, then I can demolish the whole guru trip. But I have to become a guru first.
You can just tell them that there's no difference between wanting money and wanting God or wanting sex. There's no difference. It's the same thing. So
speaking of
looking for God in a spiritual state, and the businessman is looking for money. Both are pursuits. Both are searching for more. More. The sannyasi wants more of God, and the money man wants more money.
What difference. What does your roommate Kunar want?
Kunar?
Kunar, is that he? He doesn't know. Well, he's
Kunal.
Young. He Kunar.
Kunal. Right now he has a girlfriend, and he would like to be able to figure out how he can make money so he can marry her and take her away from her family and start his own family and keep the tradition of the family. Going and going and going and going forever and ever and ever. That's what everybody else wants.
And do you tweak him on that? Do you critique that?
I push him into it. Get her. Get her before they marry her off. Go get her. Run away.
Why do you do that?
Because in India, the parents choose the husband and wife. The couple doesn't. They call it a love marriage, and it happens when kids are in college. They meet, fall in love, and they run away from the parents and get married. And oftentimes, the marriage doesn't last because it's not founded on an economic foundation. And India's marriage is based on economy. Based on money, keeping the money in the family. Now Kunal is here, and he's got a gun, and he's pointing it at my head.
because we're talking about him?
About Kunal, yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't like that.
He doesn't care.
Okay, but the point is that this could be a love marriage, then it will economically fall apart, and then the woman will have to go back to the family arrangement. So you're saying that many Indian
they don't want the parents to be hurt. That's all. Yeah.
Right, but you're saying that what can I say?
The parents want her to be economically sound.
Right, so you're saying that there's many couples in India who are now married had earlier relationships with another lover, and so they basically have two lives in love.
Well, some are still married, you know. Some are still married, some have worked out, some haven't worked out. There are lots, like in Bombay, where it's very changing very rapidly. The speed of everything is accelerating, and so culture is changing here very rapidly. And you know, if you have the money, economics, then it doesn't matter. You know,
it's right.
Yeah, and there's more. In America, it's the same. You've got to have money for a marriage to work.
Right. So some, you're saying some of these young couples, then when the money thing falls out, they split, and the daughter goes back home and accepts the arranged marriage.
Yeah. Or then they find a husband for her, some other husband, suitable husband. Yeah.
Are Indian college kids as promiscuous as American college kids?
No, but they're doing it.
You mean they're going towards that?
Yeah.
No, oh, they're doing it, but they're not too promiscuous.
Not as much, but it's headed that way.
It's headed that way. Yeah. It's going to be great when we reincarnate, Bob. We're going to get laid a lot. It's changing by 2050. Everybody be screwing everybody. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
I'm coming back.
It's all. I mean, what, 40, 50 years ago in America, it was against the law for a black man to marry a white woman, right?
Or to be gay.
And it was, to marry outside what the parents thought was right, right?
Yeah.
You always had to have the parents' approval, more or less. And the parents wanted to get rid of you, so they approved.
And now they can't even have a family, a two-parent family.
Yeah.
It's single families.
Yeah, that's the trend, yeah.
I mean, well, it's...
On that note...
maybe it's a good one.
Call it an end.
Okay, I did have one more little point. We'll end with this. Sure. You say you have a lot of young friends. Do you meet... How did you meet Kunal? Why are you guys roommates?
I met him accidentally, we were talking. I met him at the Gateway of India, and we got talking. And then he said that he would go with me to the train station. And he was also going to Bandra, I believe, and he would ride that far with me. And it's a custom in India to treat older people with a sense of respect. So he said, listen, I'll ride to Andheri with you, where I was getting off. I told him where I lived. And he said, and see you home. It's just a matter of respect, you know? So he took me to my flat, and I said, good night. And he said, can I see you tomorrow? And I said, yes. So the next day he came, and we were talking. And I found out where he was from and what he was doing in Bombay. And we became friends over the weeks. And I saw that he needed, a support system, or he would have to go back to Bombay, to his homeland, so I said, well, we can make an arrangement. And so one thing led to the other, and we became friends.
But did you become lovers?
No.
But he would have to go back to a small town someplace, outside Bombay. So and how long ago was that?
3 years ago.
Three years.
Yeah.
And you meet young friends through him and through the movie business and all around, right?
Yeah. Wherever. If you go to a mall, and chances are, because you're a foreigner, someone will talk to you, pretty much, because they're curious about foreigners, and they want to, have that experience of knowing someone from a different culture, So that's often the lead-in to the meeting them.
But right. Could you just put your plug in? I think the plug is loose again.
Okay, how's that?
It seems better. So the thing is that where you are is a good place for old people, senior citizens to go, because you get attention and you have a social life.
Asia is that way. It's very, they have a cultural structure there which gives them a certain sense of they don't see you as older in terms of something to do that's discarded, thrown away, like in America, where older people are not even looked at.
That's right.
Acknowledged. Sad.
You know, what's interesting is that you dreamt of being in India all your life, and when you got there, there were some aspects of India culture that you just mentioned are help an older senior citizen to have a more active life. And on top of that, it was the fact you were an American, not an Indian, that it also increased your social existence. So it was ironic and paradoxical. Your whole life dream to be in India was actually you prefiguring that it was a great place to retire in.
I told you I was 40 years ago I was in Hyderabad, and I was on the rooftop of the house one evening, and I by myself I was sitting up there on a chair enjoying the evening and the sounds of the night and so forth, and I suddenly said, I wonder if I will be here when I retire. I'll come here when I'm older. It wouldn't be such a bad place to be. Of course, the India that was that India only exists now in the villages and outskirts and small towns. The cities now are like any big metropolitan city.
Right. So that intuition, which was just a product of brain chemistry, not any precognition force. It's like I would like to be here if I was an older person as it is now. You end up there 40 years later, it's not like that. So the feeling of you would be there has a different, the results had a different content. It's because you were still in America when you actually got there. Because it's like America, it's becoming America.
Yeah. Eugene pushed me to come here. He said I should come here and stay here. Give it a try.
He was right about that for you.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave it at that. Eugene was right.
So we'll take a break for a month or less, but I'll write to you, email you when I'm in Thailand and let you know what's happening, and then we'll rendezvous again, right?
Yes, and I will get Buzz Kostin to maybe... send me your phone number tonight or today, and then I'll see if he's going to see you in Thailand. See if that's.
I'm going to have a different phone number in Thailand. I'm going to have another chip, another SIM card.
So right. So you'll send.
I'll email you or message you that. I'll email you because I don't have your. Do you have a cell phone or not?
No.
Okay.
No. Email me. Yeah.
I'll email you. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Ready? Great.
Okay,
very
Scott.
Good.
Yes.
Take care.
Thank you. Good night.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Very good, Bob. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.